It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For years, he's been considered the most powerful politician in Wisconsin, serving as Speaker of the State Assembly for a record 13 years.
Last week, Republican Robin Voss of Rochester announced that he will step down at the end of his term, leaving a seat he first won back in 2004.
Voss's retirement comes as Republicans are still working towards a deal with Governor Evers on whether to use the state's budget surplus for property tax relief and school funding.
I caught up with Speaker Voss yesterday to talk about where the work on the deal is and what the legislature might still accomplish before he wraps up his time in office. Your negotiations over the state's budget surplus with Governor Evers, it started with a laser focus on lowering property taxes, but a couple factors that could affect that, the governor's 400-year partial veto and more general state aid for schools, those, you know, seem to be off the table. Have your talks gotten off track?
I don't think so. I mean, they're still in the very early stages. I would say the good news is we both agree on the idea that property taxes are too high and we need to do something about it. We think it's best to be able to get the money either directly back to the people who are paying the bill so that they can decide how best to spend it, or putting it into direct relief where it goes on the property tax bill and you'll be able to see the reduction. The governor wants to give the money to schools, a different way of getting the money out the door. We're certainly open to finding something in the middle, but it's probably not going to be all his way or all our way. We're going to have to find a compromise.
Very early stages. What does that mean?
We've met with the governor once by Zoom, but he was gone to the National Governors Association. So we've met with his staff since. We haven't met yet this week, but the hope is we'll be able to keep things rolling along.
The plan that you and Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu backed earlier this month is a more than $2.3 billion package. It's pairing a tax rebate with additional funding for special education and then the one-time tax rebates. But it would nearly completely erase the state's projected budget surplus. Can the state afford to take that step when any number of factors could leave us in a deficit?
There's no doubt we can, because don't forget, in the last budget that we passed, we left a pretty healthy balance of $500 million. The good news for Wisconsinites is that we have a huge rainy day fund. We actually have so much in the rainy day fund by statute, we stopped putting more into it. And we also have a statutory balance. So all of those are already built into the equation. So the money that came in, about $2 billion more than we thought. So now, rather than keeping that money in Madison, we think it's important to get it back to people who are paying high costs of everything associated with inflation. So, yeah, we certainly can do it. And the idea of trying to make sure we're responsible, I mean, in the plan we gave the governor, it's a one-time rebate. So we would know certainly the money is there. It's whether or not we can keep it going forward. So if the governor wants to have something more permanent, I'm certainly open to that. But again, it can't just be all spending. It has to be tax relief mixed in with some increased funding for schools.
Some increased funding for schools. What do you envision?
Well, the good news is we had that bipartisan budget that passed what seems like forever ago, but just last summer. We had the largest increase in spending on special education since the state started funding it. So that was a really good step forward. But because we put a provision in the budget that now says school districts that spend more than $30,000 in a school year on any special ed student get that reimbursed at 90%. Well, there's a big demand for that funding. So the money actually that we allocated based on the estimates of what had been done in the past came up short. So we would put more money into special education to keep the commitment that we promised in the budget. And again, we still have plenty of money left to be able to make sure we do some kind of property tax relief through the school levy credit or the rebates that we've talked about as well.
There was zero increase of general state aid for public schools in this two-year budget. And now we hear superintendents from districts all over the state who are asking the legislature to set aside politics and increase school funding. Now there's a lawsuit against the legislature. You know, schools are having trouble with basic things, keeping lights on, keeping the heat on, trying to make payroll. You know, what will Republicans do about that? Why isn't there action?
Well, there has been action, which is why if you go back to that bipartisan budget that Governor Evers signed, we actually did exactly what the schools requested. They said put the resources into special ed, which is why we had the largest increase really in the history of the program. So that is exactly what they asked us to do. Now, one of the things that Wisconsinites probably aren't aware of but there are 10,000 fewer students that are in first grade than students are in seniors in high school. So we have declining populations of students in almost every single school district in the state. And the idea that we're going to be able to keep every school district the exact same as it was and every school open with fewer students every single year just because of birth rates, that's got to change. So we want to make sure that school districts are making wise decisions. I mean, they have the ability to figure out what to do. Many of them decided to max out because of the governor's 400-year veto property tax increases. So I'm certainly open to the idea that we would put it into property tax relief, but just putting it into more spending without any kind of accountability built in is bad for the taxpayer and certainly not going to fix the problem because we have this declining enrollment issue.
So inflation is not an excuse for these districts not to be able to make ends meet.
No, I mean, we've already been able to see that. I mean, part of the challenge is that in the school funding formula, because it's based on the number of students, if you had 1,000 students, you know, you get X dollars. Well, if you only have 900, you get less money from the state and the local property taxpayer. So it's really a factor of declining enrollment. That's really what the structural problem is. So we've got to find ways. You know, the state of Wisconsin has 10% of the population of California, but we have more school districts. So the idea that, again, we can keep everything like we always have with changing times probably can't occur. So we want to sit with the governor and have a good faith negotiation to say, look, let's put more money into special ed like we promised. I mean, we're certainly open to looking at increased funding for schools, but it's got to be focused on property tax relief and fundamental changes to keep schools healthy going forward, not just kind of putting it into the same system without any real reforms.
We're in conversation with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who announced he's retiring at the end of his term after 13 years leading the Assembly. So as you look out in the months ahead, state legislature out of session, there are floor session dates available next month, in addition to the possibility of a special session. What legislation, if any, would warrant bringing the Assembly back into session for you?
Well, the good news is that we've been working really hard for all of last year and this year. So keeping with the tradition of, you know, basically 50 years, the legislature adjourns in the spring so that we can focus the policymaking and the politics and make sure that they never cross each other. So, of course, we will come back if we get any kind of a deal with Governor Evers. So we can call an extraordinary session. We can have a special session. There are floor days in March, so it's certainly possible. But on all the other items that we've taken up, I feel like those are pretty much set. They worked their way through the committee process, and now it's just up to the Senate to act on a lot of the good work that we did in the Assembly.
So you don't feel it would be likely that the Assembly would be called back?
Only if we get a deal with Governor Evers. So if we certainly keep negotiating and can find a way to return the surplus to property taxpayers and fund schools, we'll be back with no challenges. But if we can't find a deal, then certainly, you know, we won't have a need to come back.
You came under fire during your tenure from some Republicans for refusing to overturn the 2020 election in Wisconsin. What do you make of President Trump's calls now to nationalize elections?
Well, I've always believed that there should be some basic standards. You know, of course, we have constitutional rights where people have the right to one person, one vote. That is not based on the state that you live in. But I think that the way we administer elections pretty much has been state-based, and I think that that is a much better way to do it. I will say on something like requiring that everyone in the country is a citizen or that everyone in the country has to show a photo ID, you know, I'm okay with that idea because it doesn't matter if you're in Alabama or Arkansas, New York or California, you should have to show a photo ID so that we don't have non-citizens or folks who aren't eligible to vote casting a ballot, you know, literally negating the efforts of us here in Wisconsin. So I don't want elections to be run nationally, but I'm okay with a few national standards like we do to guarantee equal access to the ballot box.
Why retire now?
You know, I've done a long time. You know, I thought about retiring a couple years ago, but then with that crazy recall against me, I didn't want to kind of reinvigorated me to say I still think I can make a difference. Wisconsin is at a pretty good spot. We've been able to show that with Republicans in a trifecta, Wisconsin literally reduced their tax burden, fully funded our schools, and made us a place that job creators want to locate. And during Governor Evers' time, we showed that we have the ability to compromise and find middle ground. I didn't get everything we wanted, and certainly the Democrats didn't either. But I think that we're at a good spot where my wife and I want to travel a little bit. Our business is growing. You know, I had a minor health issue that kind of just made me realize, while I love what I do and I think I've done a good job, it's time to pass the baton and let somebody else have a turn.
You mentioned the recall against you in 2022. We're headed toward an election cycle now where President Trump's approval rating is near a record low. Do state GOP candidates need to distance themselves from the president? What is the strategy heading into the midterms?
I don't think so. I mean, there was a brand new poll that was out just today that shows President Trump at 44%, which is pretty much the standard where second-term presidents are. So it's no surprise that, you know, he's at that point. He has been able to win across the country, and especially in Wisconsin, where he's been a 50-50 candidate. You know, our candidates have always overperformed the top of the ticket, whether it was Barack Obama or Donald Trump. So I think our candidates will do that again. They have to fight for what they believe in. The best part about this election cycle, Kate, is it's not about federal issues. Once every 12 years, there's no U.S. Senate race on the ballot, and it's really just about what's best for Wisconsin. And I think if you look what we've done, from making sure that we have funding for childcare and a university, for schools, trying to focus on tax relief, I think we have a really good record that people are going to look and say, you know, this isn't about Washington. This is about people who live in Waukesha and, you know, every other place in Wisconsin. I was interested that the Democrats are trying to make it about Donald Trump because they don't have really much to offer here in Wisconsin beyond empty rhetoric. So my hope is that the citizens of Wisconsin will say we want it to be about what we need, not about what's happening in a faraway capital.
Very quickly, what do we need here in Wisconsin?
Well, we have demographic challenges. One of the things that we know is that this huge surplus that we have, the biggest chunk of it is from capital gains. And that's successful people who are living in Wisconsin because we have a reasonable tax climate. And we certainly don't want to have Democrats focused on increasing taxes and driving job creators out, like is happening in California or New York or some of these places where people are literally fleeing for warmer, cheaper climates. I think we have demographic challenges. We have to make sure we have good quality services, but I think we've done a good job with that. So there's a lot of things that Wisconsin has to offer. We just have to focus on the positive and keep the cost of living as low as we can for the people who are lucky enough to choose to live here.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, thank you for joining us.
Always enjoy it, Kate. Have a good day.
That is Republican State Representative Robin Voss of Rochester, the Speaker of the State Assembly. He announced this month that he is retiring at the end of this term.
Coming up, dozens of pedestrians die each year in vehicle-related crashes in Wisconsin. A traffic engineer tells us what more can be done.
We're moving in the right direction, but we're still seeing way too many of our pedestrians dying on our roadways, along with our drivers and our bicyclists and everybody else.
Making roads less dangerous for people on foot, that's next on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, after several pedestrian deaths on Wisconsin roads in the last month, we hear from a traffic engineer about what cities can be doing to make roads safer.
That's just ahead. First, it's the WPR Winter Member Drive Executive Editor. Kyla Calvert-Mason is with us here in the studio. Hi, Kyla.
Hi.
The largest source of funding for WPR programs is from listeners like you. This drive is your chance to support all the programs you listen to throughout the year. Take that important step when you donate at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Your gift during this Winter Member Drive is so important because it directly supports your daily listening, the trustworthy reporting and thought-provoking conversations that you come here for are available thanks to you. Choose an amount, then make your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We just heard from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss talking about his priorities in his last months in office as he's announced his retirement. This is one of the things we do all the time here in Wisconsin, on Wisconsin Public Radio. We bring your elected officials, state leaders on to bring you up to date on what they're working on, get their perspective, push back on that perspective as well. WPR is listener supported, and that means that when you give, you are helping bring that contact and accountability to elected officials in Wisconsin. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 to make that conversation and so many more conversations possible. Choose the amount that works for you, take a few minutes, and then make your gift.
Now that you've decided to support Wisconsin Public Radio, you might be looking for the best way to make your gift. And the answer is become a sustainer. You decide on a monthly amount to be charged to your bank account or credit card, and you set it up to be ongoing.
A sustaining gift is a powerful way of donating because it provides reliable funding for the programs you count on. You make it easy to pay a monthly gift, and those donations add up to have a big impact for WPR. Choose an amount like $10 or $20 a month and then become a sustainer right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Here at WPR, we are so proud to have served the people of Wisconsin for the past, for more than 100 years with exactly that as our mission. Community support has made this journey possible, and we thank you for continuing that support now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I've just learned a lot by listening to public radio. I feel like I can use it. It's something I can use in my life and learn more or do something different or think differently. It kind of runs in my family. My mom listens to public radio. My dad listens to public radio. My brother listens to public radio, although I think he's unlucky because he lives in New York and we have the best public radio here. I've traveled around the country and this is the best. I'm Katie Simonson from Burlington. Wisconsin Public Radio is my source for news and information.
Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 to make your donation to Wisconsin Public Radio. It is Wisconsin Today. Kyla Calvert-Mason is in the studio with us. Your support during this winter member drive makes all the news and conversations and inspiration you enjoy on WPR possible. Your gift of $10 or $20 a month, whatever amount you choose, is the right amount to give.
The little things that we spend money on add up, especially nowadays. Maybe you buy a morning coffee or a bag of chips or a candy bar from the vending machine after lunch just to get you through the afternoon. You might spend $20 a month on small expenses, or probably more, but they're an important part of your day.
And so is listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Like the money you spend on that well-deserved treat, make your gift of $20 a month now for the programs that enrich your daily life at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We live in generous communities. We're quick to help a neighbor or coworker in need, and we chip in for good causes. And you can continue that tradition of generosity when you support WPR right now.
If you've never given to WPR before, step up and give right now. When you do, you'll be funding the programs that you and many others benefit from every day. A lot of first-time donors will give $120 or $10 a month, but the amount is totally up to you. The important thing is to make your first-ever gift. You can do it online. It takes just a couple few minutes at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you can ask for your WPR logo mug when you give $12 a month or more. Support one treasured Wisconsin station, WPR, and enjoy your favorite beverage while listening. Ask for your WPR logo mug at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you are a sustaining member, thank you so much for your continued support. Think about making today the day you bump that up. You increase your support of WPR, maybe $5 or $10 a month. You choose the amount again at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
WPR is such an awesome service that John from Oak Park, Illinois, donates and says, we're always tuned in to WPR when we're in Wisconsin.
Thank you so much, John. How about you? Join John and thousands of others in supporting this great service on WPR with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you.
Now, this year so far, at least three pedestrians have been killed in vehicle-related crashes in our state. Victims included a 77-year-old woman in Madison, a 57-year-old man in Caledonia, and 17-year-old Sasha Rosen, who was hit by a car while on his way to school in Madison.
Last year, 42 pedestrians died in vehicle-related crashes in Wisconsin. Though pedestrian deaths in Wisconsin have been decreasing since 2022, traffic engineers say there are still ways drivers and city planners can do more to reduce deaths.
To hear about ways to make streets safer for pedestrians, we have Andy Bill, Associate Director of the Traffic Operations and Safety Laboratory at UW-Madison. And Andy stepped away from a conference to join us. Andy, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
What are some of the main factors in pedestrian-related crashes? What comes up?
For sure. That's a great question. As we're thinking about them, there is, what does the roadway infrastructure look like? What are the types of vehicles that are on the roadway? What are the speeds that are happening on that roadway? And then what is happening with the interaction between the drivers and the pedestrians itself? We kind of think about this as a system, and we like to call it a safe system. And so it's broken up into five major components: the users, the vehicles, the speeds, the roads, and the post-crash care component of it.
What is the post-crash care component? What does that entail?
So as we're thinking about it, is how quickly does our ambulance or first responders get notified of a crash? And then how quickly can that person then get to a, you know, trauma one center if they need it or things of that sort? So in our urban areas, notifications happen a lot quicker and there are things that happen that go along with that. But as we think about our rural areas, we do have to be really careful in terms of what is happening out there in terms of, is someone going to notice them? How quickly does it get to a trauma one center? And what do we look like for that?
Andy, when you look at the data around the state, how common are pedestrian-related crashes in Wisconsin?
Yeah, unfortunately, as we're thinking about it, it is pretty consistent in our pedestrian fatalities across the state. We're continuously seeing them between 50 and 60, sometimes even up to 80 fatalities amongst our state. We did see a decrease in 2025 from about, you know, an average of 70-ish down to 50. So we're moving in the right direction, but we're still seeing way too many of our pedestrians dying on our roadways, along with our drivers and our bicyclists and everybody else.
And you note that these crashes can be complicated. What are some of the scenarios that could contribute to a crash?
There are scenarios such as somebody is walking on a rural highway or running or, you know, out for exercise that goes along with it. And then maybe there's a curb that comes up and drivers aren't expecting to see a pedestrian out there. And so we then have those interactions between a driver maybe not paying 100% attention and then not thinking that there'd be a pedestrian out there and then having a crash like that. In our urban areas, we see situations where people are running late and we're seeing some speeding issues or just traveling too fast for conditions and, you know, trying to kind of push their way through traffic and not see a pedestrian. In our urban areas, too, we see that there's a lot of things going on and competing for our drivers' kind of frame of reference and what they're looking at, right? So you might see lights, you might see parked cars, and then all of a sudden there's a pedestrian there that you don't expect to see, right? So there's that expectancy that's kind of changing a little bit. And so we're trying to kind of balance all of those. And the unfortunate part about it is just basic physics. A human body is not meant to withstand crash forces, and especially if that crash force is from a vehicle itself, right? That is a very large kinetic energy transfer, and that's what causes a crash to become a severe crash or a fatal crash, is that energy transfer.
What are you seeing by way of phones and the electronics in the car? What impact is that having?
For sure. I mean, we are seeing more distracted driving out there. We've always had distractions in our vehicles, but now we have more things that are happening and more things that are competing for our driver's attention that goes along with it. And so, especially in the areas where we have, it's the two sides, right? In our rural areas, people that are distracted and not thinking that they might see a pedestrian, that comes up quickly. And in our urban areas, that distraction is just inside the vehicle and outside that vehicle. And so it's really thinking about how do all of this kind of play together.
I want to turn to Vision Zero, and in counties all over Wisconsin, the Vision Zero initiative that aims to eliminate traffic fatalities. What are some of the specific changes that cities are implementing in their toolbox of options to make this a reality?
It's a great point. I think a lot of folks don't think that Vision Zero is possible. my question always back to that is, okay, then who, right? Nobody wants any of their family members to die from a motor vehicle collision or crash that goes along with it. The areas that are looking at Vision Zero are really looking at how do we adapt the culture to understanding the effects these crashes have on it, and how do we look at each one of those parts? So what can we do from a roadway infrastructure standpoint? So whether in urban areas, are we looking at kind of extending the sidewalk out a little bit more to, we call it a bulb out at the intersection, to kind of get past those parked cars so those pedestrians are more visible? Are we looking at it from reducing the speed? City of Madison has done a campaign of 20 is plenty on the residential streets to try to slow folks down, understanding that it is a kinetic energy transfer. And so the slower we can get vehicles to go, the more likely if a crash happens or when a crash happens, it's survivable. As we're thinking about our user standpoint, trying to educate our drivers and their role in this effect, and then our pedestrians to have them understand how does it work out in terms of their visibility and not having this false sense of security that just because a light changes means it's safe to cross, and kind of how do we do that? So we're trying to do each one of those components in those Vision Zeros. When you think about it from a city perspective or a county perspective, they're really thinking about what did they have control over? And so that's what the infrastructure and the users and education component to it.
Andy Bill is with us, director of the Wisconsin Local Technical Assistance Program and associate director of the Traffic Operations and Safety Lab at UW-Madison. We're talking about pedestrian safety and how to make roads safer for walkers and bikers. Andy, there was a Washington Post investigation published in December showing that Vision Zero is failing in many cities, and larger cities like Los Angeles have actually seen the death rates increase. Where do you think does Vision Zero fall short?
Yeah, so I think some of it is it's being criticized as unattainable, right? So how do we get to this zero, and what do we look at it with it, and how do we kind of balance the idea of that safety and moving traffic through? And so it does have a require a significant investment as well. And so it's being able to tie in that community component to it and saying, how are we as a community going to change the culture around our traffic safety practices and our driving practices and our walking practices? And then how do we look at the financial need for doing the infrastructure changes and things of that sort? So being able to kind of look at that and being able to say, how do we pull that together? We're all used to being in our own, if we're in our own vehicles, we want to drive at our speed and do what we want. But understanding that there's a culture that's associated with that is a really important component to it, is what is the culture that our community is willing to accept?
Andy, you've studied roundabouts, and we see them on Wisconsin state highways. How do roundabouts affect pedestrian safety?
That's a great question. As we think about roundabouts, and for pedestrians explicitly, it is slowing the vehicles down. You know, we think about a green light, people can go through at whatever speed that they were traveling prior to that coming up to that intersection. It doesn't matter what part of that roundabout that you're coming into, you have to slow down. And we try to get folks down to that 10 miles an hour, which we know that if a collision occurs at that 10 miles an hour, it is a lot more survivable for that pedestrian. So it comes down to getting those drivers to slow down. And because of the interaction, it's also getting them to pay a little bit more attention to what's going on around them. So kind of trying to reduce some of that distraction that's happening at more maybe our traditional intersections where, you know, I'm going to just ask the audience to kind of think about it. Has there been a time where you traveled through a signalized intersection and afterwards you go, huh, was that light red or green, right? Most of the time we just, you know, subconsciously see it and go through it, but you know, we're not always fully processing what that color of that traffic signal is at that point in time.
Do you find that city planners are increasingly looking to roundabouts as they design their intersections, or where are we at with roundabouts?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a really good tool in the toolbox in terms of our interchanges and our intersections to make sure that they are being as safe as possible. It's reducing those conflict points for the other vehicles. There are other types of intersections that also reduce conflict points. So we might see a diverging diamond interchange on some of our interstate off-ramps, some of our J-turns across the state, which again is trying to reduce those angle crashes for those motor vehicles. But along with that, it also helps kind of slow folks down and have a better understanding for our pedestrians as well, too. So really looking at those, we call them alternative intersections, but I think that they are becoming more and more of the norm to reduce conflict points and try to slow traffic down.
When you look at these conflict points, you know, in the case of Sasha Rosen, the boy who was walking across a multi-lane busy section of Madison. Another case was a 77-year-old woman killed crossing another heavily trafficked area. Is part of the issue pedestrians are forced to walk in dangerous areas?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to kind of think about that, right? So with a multi-lane roadway, as we think about it with regards to crossing, right? Some of the issue with those larger type roadways is that the speeds are higher. And then as we are thinking about it with regards to multiple lanes, you might see someone that stops in the lane closest to the pedestrian, right, on that sidewalk. And then from there, the person that's traveling in that next lane over may not understand why that vehicle is slowing down. So they continue to go through, but that pedestrian does not think that that other vehicle is going to be coming, right? And so then you have what we call kind of a secondary threat that kind of goes along with this. When one vehicle stops, but then a driver in the adjacent lane doesn't, striking the pedestrian as they cross through. And so we have to look to see better explanation of, do we have enough visibility for those pedestrians? Are folks expecting to see what's going on out there? Roads are large. You know, you're getting into those conflict points on those multi-lane roadways. And so that definitely increases it as you go across those roads.
As we close here, Andy, AI increasingly a part of our life. Is there a big breakthrough in traffic engineering that is on the horizon that you see?
I hope so. We're putting more of our emphasis, especially with some of the research at the university, with regards to technology and how that plays out into it. So whether that's some sort of automated vehicles that are going to be able to detect our pedestrians, and then for our pedestrians themselves, are there ways for us to be able to alert pedestrians if people are looking down and they're distracted with their cell phones, that there is a car coming towards them and being able to look at it? So, you know, with AI and technology and things of that sort, are there ways to be able to better communicate when these types of interactions may or may not occur and help be able to give better information to those pedestrians and to those drivers about what they should be expecting?
Andy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Andy Bill is director of the Wisconsin Local Technical Assistance Program and associate director of the Traffic Operations and Safety Laboratory at UW-Madison. We've been learning about how to make roads safer for pedestrians and how to slow traffic.
Coming up, a debut novelist from Wisconsin is inspired by Indigenous American mythology and wants to make Native folklore come alive in his new book for middle grade readers.
How do I celebrate these cultures, this piece of myself, in a way that also any kid can pick up? I came around to this idea of living myths.
The author of Myth Speaker, next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Wisconsin author's debut middle grade novel is a thrilling fantasy adventure inspired by Indigenous American folktales.
A 13-year-old boy is destined to save the world. Kyla and his friends have to return the precious egg of the world turtle that's been stolen by invaders, and all living things are at risk of perishing because everything exists on the vast shell of the world turtle continent.
Wisconsin author Christopher Rubik draws from his Cajun and rural Wisconsin upbringing in his novel called Myth Speaker. It explores themes of teamwork, self-worth, and respect for nature. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
You didn't fit in as a kid growing up in rural Elkhart Lake. What was hard?
Well, it's one of those funny things about growing up in a small town is that everyone knows everyone. The town never changes. And that's wonderful in some ways, but especially as a kid who doesn't fit in, unfortunately, once you don't fit in, you never do. And so for me, that kind of meant that starting from a pretty young age, you're a known quantity. I always tried my best. I cared a lot about school and doing well. And those are great things, but it also became something where teachers and other parents would say, oh, you know, he's special. He's, you know, he's doing well in school. He's involved in these programs or things like that. And that word special became something that followed me all through school until I graduated. And special is wonderful right up until it isn't.
How do you process those things differently, or how does it inform your writing your novel, Mythspeaker?
So Mythspeaker fundamentally, like, you know, especially kids' books, is a story of a chosen one, of a destined hero, someone who has been told from, well, in Kaita's case, since he was 5 years old, that he was going to save the world, that he was going to have to. And that happens all the time. We have so many stories like that. But for me, the part of that that I never really saw in things, but that I felt from when I was a little kid, was how hard that has to be. I have this vivid memory, and I've written a little bit about this elsewhere, of being in the fifth grade, and we were doing a parent-teacher conference, and the teacher was saying, oh, you know, he's done really well, his grades are great, et cetera. And then he looked at my mom and very completely seriously said, I think he's going to be the president one day, and I think he'll be great. And he wasn't joking, he meant it. And I remember sitting there, I mean, fifth grade, so what was I, nine? Maybe 10?
About 10, yeah.
Yeah, about 10, so, you know, middle grade age. And I remember sitting there thinking, I don't know how to be a president. I don't know if I can do that. How am I going to learn how to do that? And it fed this same sort of thing that always kind of followed me, this idea that it's wonderful to be special. It's wonderful for Kaita to be a destined hero, except how do you live up to that? How do you make that work as you get older?
Kaita, this 13-year-old who learns through a prophecy, as you say, that he will save the world. Mm-hmm. Kaita is also born with this extraordinary gift of understanding any language, any language. Why did you give Kaita this gift?
So there's two pieces to that. And one of them is very under the hood writing, kind of. When you're introducing, you know, a fantasy world, and for Mythspeaker, I wrote a language for the book. So all of the character names, the little bits of words we get in other languages, that is a language. Those words mean things. And I loved the idea of that. But I realized, you know, the fundamental other side of the story is that there are people coming from not just another place on Kaita's continent, which is on the back of a enormous flying turtle, but they're coming from a different continent altogether. They will not understand a word of the languages spoken where Kaita is from, and no one on Kaita's side will understand their languages either. So the first part of it just emerged from, I need some way for Kaita to be able to understand what's being said and what's going on. And since this world is one built around not just myth, but living myth, you know, these are characters living amidst the figures of their stories going back thousands of years, why not then tie that sort of living history of the world into Kaita and solve two problems, both make him something special, but not in the way of, you know, he's not super strong or super fast, he isn't super smart, he might be super sarcastic sometimes. He probably has that going. But I love the idea of, if he has any quote-unquote superpower, it's just that he can understand anyone.
You talk about living myth, and we meet Old Moon Eyes, and he's not just a frog. He is a living myth, and he talks. So can you describe what are living myths in indigenous folklore, and why are they so wise?
Living myths is a term I came up with for this book to try and capture one of the recurring themes of Indigenous American mythology, a thing you see, you know, across the stories of the whole continent. And it's worth noting that, you know, there are many hundreds of unique cultures that have lived in just North America over the last, you know, hundreds and thousands of years, and that they all have unique stories and histories and cultures. But many of them, you often see animals and not just any animals, but special animals and at times spirits, or I don't want to say inhuman, but other human beings that interact with people, sometimes equally, sometimes very much not equally. And they're used to explain things in the world that, you know, these native groups, these amazing cultures were seeing around them at the time these stories first came to be. And when I was thinking about how do I celebrate these cultures, this piece of myself in a way that also any kid can pick up and understand, I came around to this idea of living myths. Because when we talk about myths, we talk about them like they're dead things. Mm-hmm. And so why not immediately outright say they're not just dead things, they're living things, and then show you one. You know, with Old Moon Eyes, we meet right away, and he is literally older than dirt. He is a forest in a, well, not a person, but a personage. And he's Kaita's best friend.
Yeah. You know, Kaita recites these words under his breath. Hope is a feeling, but faith is a choice, a fire we keep burning, even if we must rub together the embers ourselves.
Yeah.
How do you identify with Kaita's words about faith?
Oh, that is a great question. And this is something that has sort of been a way of looking at the world that I've grown into as I've gotten older. I have always been an optimist. I've been called a hopeless optimist because I believe in the wonder of things. Mm. The author John Green has said in recent years, hope is correct. And I really do believe that. But the tough thing about hope is that a lot of the time hope is a feeling, and feelings are mutable. Feelings change from moment to moment based on what we're thinking. Faith goes deeper than that. Faith is trusting in something or someone. It can be yourself. It can be the people around you. It can be institutions or your religious beliefs. And for me, especially when I started writing this book, we had just come out of the pandemic, and I saw so many people struggling with, like, okay, what are we hopeful for? What are we moving forward toward? Yeah. And for me, this book and that theme, because faith is a recurring theme of the book, it was all about remembering that even when you don't feel hope necessarily, A, it doesn't mean that it's not there. Feelings are, you know, like, they change all the time. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they're not, you know, with you just because you don't feel it. But also, faith is something you can choose no matter what. And even if it means you have to remind yourself of it, you have to rub those embers together, you have to put in the work, that faith, that trust can always be there. And that faith and trust most of the time leads you right back to the hope you were looking for.
Christopher, thank you so much for sharing Myth Speaker with us, and thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That is Wisconsin author Christopher Rubik. His debut middle grade novel called Myth Speaker is inspired by Indigenous American mythology and his rural Wisconsin upbringing.
Now it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Member Drive. Kyla Calvert-Mason is with us here in the studio, and we're here to raise the money that pays for the programs you enjoy, programs like Wisconsin Today. Support from people like you is the largest piece of funding for WPR programs, and that's why your support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is so important.
That's right. Wisconsin Public Radio is listener-powered. That means your support makes WPR's news, analysis, conversations, and weekend fun available not only for you, but for the entire community. Thank you for making WPR's public service mission possible with your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Another great conversation with a Wisconsin author there. And I love that we're able to do these on Wisconsin Today. We've got so many great creative people in the state, and we get to hear not just about them and their work, but also about how traditions and landscapes and more in Wisconsin shape the work that they do. It's an example of the spotlight we put on Wisconsin here on Wisconsin Today. And because WPR's listeners supported, when you give, you're making that possible. Make your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Choose an amount that works for you. Take a couple few minutes and make your gift.
And you can ask for your WPR logo mug when you give $12 a month or more. Support one treasured Wisconsin station, WPR, and enjoy your favorite beverage while listening. Ask for your WPR logo mug now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We've got that mug here in the studio, one of them. I like it so much, I accidentally walked off with it after the show yesterday.
Accidentally.
I had to confess my crime. You just start scooping stuff up. But it is a really nice mug, yours for $12 a month or more. Hey, here at WPR, our shareholders are members, listeners like you who value thoughtful, independent programming, and then they support it with their donations. We're sure that you can hear the difference every day. That's why you choose Wisconsin Public Radio.
Right now, we're asking you to become a shareholder at WPR. Make your monthly gift online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
We know folks love a good mug, especially WPR supporters. And we've got a special one for you this drive. It will quickly become your favorite.
I would describe it as a speckled mug.
My son would use this the most because he loves orange.
Looks like we got sort of a camp mug looking thing here.
I would always have it filled with a hot beverage. Tea.
Coffee every day. Lots of coffee.
Hot cocoa for sure.
Hot chocolate.
My hot tea in the afternoon.
Ask for your WPR logo mug when you give $12 a month or more. Here's how.
Make that gift. Get that mug at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 during this winter member drive. It's Wisconsin Today. Kyla Calvert-Mason is in the studio with us. Join in with your gift right now because WPR's essential service is available to you and your community thanks to your support.
Maybe you've found yourself thinking about something in a new way after you've listened to Wisconsin Public Radio, or I know I find myself thinking about things hours or days later. They just sort of are still rolling around in my mind. You can count on hearing multiple points of view on these talk shows thanks to the producers who track down interesting and knowledgeable guests. WPR is listener supported. That means you make eye-opening, ear-opening programs possible when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Once in a while, you actually get more than you pay for. And WPR is one place where that's true every day. Consider a gift of $2 a day to support the radio programs you love.
You can't buy much anymore for $2, but at Wisconsin Public Radio, $2 a day makes a lot of important news and information available to you and people across this state. That works out to $60 a month, and you can make that gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
However you choose to give and however much you choose to give, thank you. Your support really makes a difference. There's another little something you could do to help along the way, though. Encourage somebody else, a friend, a loved one, an enemy, whatever. Join the Wisconsin Public Radio community.
That's right. Spread the love. Tell your friends and family that you support WPR. Tell them about that thing you're still thinking about days later. Inspire them to make a gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Ask for that WPR logo mug this drive. Support the WPR programs you value and show off your love of Wisconsin Public Radio in this stylish mug. I every day I look at it, it's growing on me. I like it more and more. I think I need to end up with one of these. Ask for your WPR, legally obtained. Ask for your WPR logo mug while supplies last at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And today, any day, really, is a great day to become a sustaining member. It's easy to set up convenient, ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or credit card. You can get started now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We heard from Carolyn in Wauwatosa. Carolyn says, Wisconsin Today is the best. Oh, thank you so much, Carolyn. That is fantastic to hear. Thank you for the kind words, and thanks for giving.
That's right. Join Carolyn now with your gift. It's powerful, and it really makes a difference. We say it again and again. WPR is here because of listener support. So become one of those supporters today at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. We can't thank you enough for your support.
Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Our managing producer is Tim Peterson.
And our executive producer is Dean Kinetter.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.